Well, good afternoon. Thank you for joining us today for Ethics Refresher Part 1. This is the first hour of a six-hour course that talks about the rules of professional conduct in the states of Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Iowa. We're doing a live teleconference today on May 4th. And we are also recording today's program for podcast listeners in Wisconsin and other states. During the course of the program, I will be giving a number of code words that podcast listeners will need to write down and send those to me to get your certificate of completion of the course so I can verify your attendance. If you're on the telephone conference call live today, you don't need to do that. Those are just strictly for the podcast. And today's program, like I say, we're going to be talking about the rules of professional conduct as adopted in the three states, Minnesota, Iowa, and Wisconsin. That's not quite as daunting a task as it seems, since the rules in all three states are, in most cases, identical, since they're all adopted from the model ABA rules. But there are some differences in the various states, and we will cover that. We will cover those. Today's live program is approved for credit in Minnesota and Wisconsin, and the podcast will be available for credit in Wisconsin as well. It's still somewhat of a daunting task. When I sat down to write this program, I assumed that we could cover the high points of the rules in a couple of hours. Since both Minnesota and Wisconsin require about 3 hours of ethics for the reporting period, I figured I could cover that. But it turns out it's impossible to cover the rules in 3 hours. So it turned into a six-hour session. And we'll look at different parts of the rules in different sessions. Today we're going to be mostly looking at the rules that start with one that discuss the lawyer's relationship and duties to his own client. And then in other sessions we will cover the other parts of the rules. Generally, when you go to ethics CLEs, it's often regarded as kind of a soft topic, where not a lot of black letter law is presented. Oftentimes, there will be a panel discussion at the end of the day to discuss some of these issues, and that's usually well and good because most of the times there is a lot of stuff open to interpretation and suitable for discussion. So that's usually an adequate way to look at the rules, and that's the way most of the CLEs do it. But I did find it helpful, just as I wrote this program, to actually go through the rules in their entirety and look at those black and white rules, many of which are very clear, very specific things that have to be done. And, of course, a lot of them are those gray areas that have to be talked about. But I still found it useful just to go through the rules in their entirety because some things have changed since I went to law school and originally took the bar exam. Also, there are some little points that are easy to forget. So today, mostly, we're going to be covering those black-letter rules. Mostly the things that don't require a lot of interpretation, and I will leave it to those panel discussions at other CLEs to talk about those things that do need interpretation. Today's course, for that reason, will probably you'll probably have some flashbacks to law school when you took the review course for the multi-state professional responsibility exam, because we're going to be kind of following the same approach. But again, since most lawyers never sit down to look at the rules in their entirety, it's kind of a good thing to do that occasionally. We're going to be talking about the model rules as adopted in each of these states, if I refer to Rule 1.7 or whatever, I'm generally referring to the rule as adopted in all three of those states, Iowa, Minnesota, and Wisconsin, and probably in about 45 other states as well, because most states in the union have adopted these rules with varying amounts of changes. But if I just refer to a rule number, that's the rules of court or the rules of professional conduct in all three states, and I've given the written materials where they can be found, generally in the state statutes or your rules of court book. And when there are differences, when one state has some individual requirement, I will talk about that and refer specifically to what state it is. Since we have just Wisconsin people on the line today, and the podcast will be for Wisconsin, I'll probably steer a little bit more toward any Wisconsin differences, but we'll also talk about the rules as they're adopted in Minnesota and Wisconsin as well. Well, again, most of these ethics CLEs you go to are more of a soft topic that talk about the areas that need discussion, and so it's a good point to start is just to look at the preamble to the rules, which kind of talk in big generalities, and it's a good idea to occasionally just to read through that preamble just to give a background of what the rest of the rules mean and what the responsibilities are under the remainder of the rules. As that preamble points out, that in many cases, and you know, again, we're going to be talking about just the black letter rules today mostly, but even in those cases and in many cases, you're going to come across conflicting responsibilities. You know, one rule will be seemingly in conflict with another one. And for that reason, many times you do have to just sit back and think about those two conflicting responsibilities. And a lot of times when you are involved in a case, or some sort of representation on a day-to-day basis, you can oftentimes kind of develop almost a tunnel vision. And sometimes those conflicting responsibilities are hard to see and hard to resolve. But sometimes somebody looking at it from outside, to that person, it will just seem a lot more clear. So in some of these cases, it is really worthwhile when you encounter some conflict between the rules, just to run it past another lawyer, you know, another lawyer in your office or another colleague, and just get their input on it. Because sometimes when I get those questions from other attorneys, the answer will seem so clear, and I can tell them what it is. But if it's something that I'm doing myself, that answer oftentimes does not seem very clear. So many times, just running it past another attorney can prove really helpful in getting some guidance. Now, one word of caution there is when you run it past somebody for some outside guidance, make sure that that person is an attorney, because not that attorneys are have a lock on good ethical advice, but as you will see later on, you know, there are many rules governing confidentiality and your ability to reveal information to third parties, which oftentimes you have to do when you're asking this kind of question. Well, we will get to that later, but one of the exceptions when you are allowed to reveal confidential information is if you are seeking legal advice on how to proceed, on what your obligations are under the rules. So if you take that to another attorney and you're seeking legal advice from that other attorney, you are protected. If it's a non-attorney, no matter how good their advice is, then you could run into problems. I don't have the cite for it right here, but there was a recent Minnesota Supreme Court case from last year that was actually not an ethics opinion, but it was a whistleblower case where the attorney was a whistleblower in a corporate environment, and he had a civil suit under the whistleblower laws. And unfortunately, he lost his case partly or mainly because During the course of this, he needed some advice on how to proceed with an ethical problem, and he got some advice that was probably good advice from his father, who the opinion identified as a retired businessman. Well, there was a little bit more to it, to the case, but essentially he lost his whistleblower case because of that violation of confidentiality. So you do have to be careful when seeking counsel on these ethical things that come up to make sure that it is an attorney that you're getting the advice from, and not just some third party, no matter how wise they happen to be. One interesting resource that's recently become available that's more of interest to Minnesota attorneys, but I think it's a good resource for attorneys in other states as well. It's cited in the materials here. It's an e-book by William Wirtz, who was for many years the director of the Minnesota Office of Lawyers' Professional Responsibility. And sitting down reading books about legal ethics isn't exactly light reading, but it's actually kind of an interesting looking book. I haven't read a lot of it yet because it just recently came out. But it's available for free, and it talks a lot about it talks about the subject in a pretty interesting way. So I kind of I would commend that to look at and just see what he has to say. One interesting point that he raised was that he kind of dispelled the myth that at one point there was a golden age of attorney ethics. At some unidentified point in the past, there was a golden age when attorneys were all ethical, and then at some point the good old days ended, and now we're in these times when lawyers are not ethical. Well, he pretty well dispels that because he goes through and tries to identify that that golden age when everybody was ethical, and he points to some pretty bad things that happened in the past. So in reality, there was no golden age of attorney ethics, and I guess our duty is to set things up such that people will look back and say 2011, that was the golden age of attorney ethics, and we can do that by following these rules. Our first code word for the podcast listeners will be golden age. Two words, golden age. That's the first word for our podcast listeners. So write that down, but not if you're driving, and get that back to me so I can, along with the other code words, so I can get you your certificate of attendance. Well, with those preliminary matters, we'll jump right into the rules. And rule 1.0 is simply a pretty comprehensive list of definitions. And we won't go through them in detail, but most of the words that we encounter today are defined in that section 1.0. So as we go through, in most cases, those definitions are pretty much the plain language meaning of the rule. But if you are looking closely at some rule, it is important to look back at rule 1.0 and make sure that you're following the correct definition of that term. But like I say, there's nothing particularly surprising in those definitions. But when you get to the point where you have to determine the exact meaning of some provision, then you need to look at at Rule 1.0. Well, Rule 1.1 moves into our first requirement of how we practice law, and like I say, a lot of what we're going to be talking today are very specific things. You know, how many days you have to wait to deposit a check into your trust account and that sort of thing. Have easy answers where you can just look at the rule and it will tell you what it is. But Rule 1.1 is not one of those rules. Rule 1.1 has a lot of interpretation, and it's good fodder for those panel discussions that you see at other CLEs, because Rule 1.1 simply says that you as a lawyer shall provide competent representation to your client. So be competent. That's the first thing we learned today. It doesn't really define what competence is, but it says what it requires. And it requires legal knowledge, skill, thoroughness, and preparation. You need to do all those things in order to be competent. One thing the rule does go on to point out, though, is basically there's a first time for everything. You have your first DWI case or your first personal injury case or your first will. There's always a first time for everything. So competence does not necessarily mean that you have long knowledge on it, because you may need to require expertise under the circumstances. But you can achieve that competence if you can do so by reasonable preparation. And I just got an email comment here, and thank you for mentioning this, because I was going to say it, that the Wisconsin State Bar has an ethics hotline for running those ethical dilemmas past another person. And there are similar resources in other states as well. And I was going to mention in Minnesota, the Office of Lawyers Professional Responsibility will actually provide advisory opinions. So you can call up one of the staff attorneys there and simply call on the phone and say you want an advisory opinion. And you can tell them what's going on, and they will tell you their opinion of what you think you ought to do. Now, that's a little bit more, slightly more problematic. It's kind of a good news, bad news thing versus talking to somebody else. The good news is that if you follow their advice, you can be pretty much assured that you won't get into trouble. Now, it's not an absolute guarantee, but there has never been a case of a lawyer in good faith following advice given on one of these advisory opinions later getting into trouble. And I think they would probably have kind of a hard time proving such a case if you called up and asked what to do. There are a couple of caveats. One kind of makes sense is that if you seek their advice and you want to rely upon it, you have to give them the full information. You can't withhold facts. You have to tell them everything relevant. But they will give an opinion, and you are pretty much protected when you do that. The other thing to keep in mind, if you call them, because they're also the office that regulates attorneys, you can be pretty certain that if there is a moral high ground that can be taken, they will take that moral high ground in their advice. So if it's a questionable case, I have this $1,000 in the trust account. Does it belong to me or does it belong to the client? Well, maybe it belongs to you. But if you call up and say I have this money in my trust account, and you reveal all the facts, and they say, well, you know, it'd probably be best if you just give it back to your client. It seems to me you're not going to be in a very strong position then if you decide, well, you know what, that would be one way to proceed, but I'm also okay keeping it myself. It's not written into the rules anywhere, but if you don't take their advice, it seems to me that that doesn't look too well for you if the issue comes up later. So if you do make that call, you want to plan on following their advice, even if it's advice that you don't want to take, and possibly even it's advice that you would not need to take, because if you looked into it a little bit more, you might have realized that, well, I could have kept this $1,000. But once they tell you that that you can't, you're not in a very strong position to do so at that point. So keep that in mind, that if you do call them, they will advise you to take the moral high ground. And I'm not sure whether Wisconsin offers official opinions such as that, but many bar associations do have a similar service as well. That you're not protected as you would by calling the regulator for an advisory opinion. Again, it solves that problem of having to have tunnel vision, and the answer might seem a lot more clear when you talk to somebody else. So anyway, that's getting back to Rule 1.1, you shall be competent. But there's a recognition that you might need to acquire that competence. And I think it goes without saying that you probably, if this is your first will and you spend several hours reading a treatise on how to write wills in your state, you probably can't bill your client for that general learning time. And that probably comes down to how specialized the area of law is, because in some cases it probably would be reasonable to achieve that competence by preparing during the case. But you shall be competent. Well, that moves us on to Rule 1.2, scope of representation and allocation of authority between you and your client. Here the general rule is, and this rule runs throughout the rules, is that you as a lawyer shall abide by your client's decisions. So in other words, the client, with very, very few exceptions, is in the driver's seat. Any decisions that need to be made are generally decisions to be made by the client. The rule goes on to say, though, first of all, that because the client is in the driver's seat and you are not making the decisions, the rule goes on to make clear that, therefore, just because you do something, well, it's because your client decided to do that. And it does not mean that you are endorsing the client's position, his political or economic or social or moral views, or you're endorsing his activities. The simplest case of that is, representing a criminal defendant. The criminal defendant has the absolute right to plead not guilty. So if you are representing a murderer, that does not mean that that you endorse murder, simply that you, as a lawyer, are required to abide by your client's decisions. There is a big exception to this, though, of the client being in the driver's seat, and that is that you as a lawyer may not assist your client in conduct that you know to be criminal or fraudulent. So, that's pretty easy. If the client comes in and says, how should I commit this crime? Well, you can't assist with that. You cannot give that advice. But then there's an exception to the exception. A lawyer may discuss the legal consequences of any proposed course of conduct and assist the client to make a good faith determination on what the law means. So that leads to a gray area in many cases. So you have a client who is charged with a crime, and he calls you up to ask what countries the United States has an extradition treaty with. That's probably one of those close calls where you might want to get an advisory opinion, because you don't want to assist in criminal conduct because fleeing the jurisdiction is a criminal conduct, so you can't assist with that. But you may discuss the legal consequences of a proposed course of conduct. So if the client says, that second sentence seems to say that if the client says, what happens if I go to Venezuela? And I don't know if Venezuela has an extradition treaty, but if they didn't, and you said, well, the consequence of your going to Venezuela would mean that you would live in a warmer climate and they wouldn't be able to extradite you. So, that's kind of a gray area. Is that assisting in criminal conduct, or is that merely discussing the legal consequences of a proposed course of conduct? So that's one of those gray areas that you need to look at. In general, the client is in the driver's seat and the lawyer shall abide by his decisions. But this rule also makes clear that the lawyer may limit the scope of the representation if it's reasonable and if the client consents to that. So, for example, you're representing a criminal defendant in a DWI case, and you know that there is also a civil lawsuit against him arising out of that. Well, if you are allowed to represent him just in the criminal case and not in the civil case, but the client must consent to that, and it has to be informed consent. And it has to be reasonable, and in that case, it's probably reasonable. Now, Wisconsin, as we shall see as we go through here, Wisconsin oftentimes has very specific provisions to cover some very specific situations. So I think this is kind of covered in general in the other states anyway, but just to make clear, Wisconsin notes that if the lawyer is retained by the insurance company to defend the insured, that's okay, and it may be limited to representation of what's covered under the policy. But the client must be informed of this. I guess the slight difference here is that in other states, the client would probably have to affirmatively consent to say, yes, you're only representing me for the $1 million lawsuit against me that's covered by the insurance policy, but you are not representing me for this other conduct that was not covered by the insurance policy. In other states, the client would probably have to give informed consent to that. Here, if it's in the insurance policy, then the client nearly needs to be informed of that. Now, chances are that policy probably gives that consent in the first place when the person first signed up for insurance. So I think that that issue is probably covered in the other states as well. But again, Wisconsin sometimes adds a little bit more specific clarification. So in Wisconsin, that situation is covered. Well, we learned that a lawyer needs to be competent and he needs to put his client in the driver's seat. Rule 1.3 says that, this is one rule that I can just quote, a lawyer shall act with reasonable diligence and promptness in representing a client. So you have to be prompt and you have to be diligent. So again, not a lot of definition is given there. But the ABA comment says that no professional shortcoming is more widely resented than procrastination. So don't procrastinate, because good will never come from it. Now, it's where this situation usually comes up, where procrastination comes into play, is when something bad happened in the case. Usually when something good happened, lawyers usually don't procrastinate too much about it. So if your client just won $1 million and he was only expecting $100, lawyers rarely procrastinate when communicating that sort of information. Invariably, though, where the procrastination comes in is when something bad has happened. Your client thought he was going to get $1 million, and they're not getting $1 million. So in that case, you have to watch out for procrastination. And bad news does not get better with time. So that's one of those that you just have to get it over with and be diligent. Don't procrastinate, because even if you didn't do anything wrong in the first place, that gets more lawyers into trouble than anything else. So don't procrastinate. Tell them the bad news right away. And speaking of communication, that moves us right on to Rule 1.4 that says when you as a lawyer must communicate. In general, you want to communicate with your clients. Well, when is that required? First of all, any time the client needs to consent to something. A client obviously can't, that's kind of common sense, because a client can't consent to something if he doesn't know that he had to do it in the first place. So any time a client's consent is needed, you have to communicate with the client and say, do you consent to this? You need to tell your client how their objectives are going to be carried out. Now, not necessarily in excruciating detail. You don't need to say, you know, I'm going to file a complaint and it's going to have an affidavit of service attached to it, and I'm going to file it at the clerk's office on the third floor. So it doesn't call you, ask you to go into excruciating detail, but you do have to let them know how their objectives are going to be carried out. I heard of one lawyer one time. Somebody at church had a speeding ticket, or a parking ticket, and this lawyer just said to him, "Well, I'll take care of that for you." So he took the parking ticket and he mailed in a check for $20 to pay the parking ticket, because it was that was a lot easier rather than just helping this person out. Well, that probably violated the rules, because he should have told the client how those objectives were going to be carried out. He should not have said, "I'm going to take care of that for you." He should have said, "I'm going to take care of it for you by paying it for you," which actually might violate another rule. But so actually, sometimes you can get in trouble for being a nice guy. But again, you have to tell your client how their objectives are going to be carried out. Don't just say, "I will take care of this." Say, you know, "We will plead not guilty," or you know, we will sue the insurance company or whatever. But you have to let them know how their objectives are going to be carried out. You have to keep them informed about the status of the matter. That probably generates more complaints to the various regulatory boards than anything else, just not communicating the status. And, you know, the easiest way to do that, I've found, is just, any correspondence that comes either into your office or out of your office, just send a copy of that to the client, maybe with a rubber stamp on it that says "for information only." Because in some cases, we'll see later on that in many of these rules do not allow you to err on the side of caution, because you have two conflicting priorities. So there is no side of caution. But here's one where you pretty clearly can err on the side of caution and just over-communicate with your client. There's hardly any way that you're going to get into trouble for over-communicating, but under-communicating will get you into trouble, even if you didn't do anything else wrong. So keep that in mind. Keep your client informed of the status of their matter. You must comply with reasonable requests for information. So if they ask, "Can I see a copy of the complaint?" You have to give it to them. Now, it says reasonable requests, so if you're busy with something else, you don't have to drop everything, but you probably do have to reply to them promptly. Finally, let the client know of any relevant limitations on your conduct. So if you're in Wisconsin and your Illinois client comes in because they had an accident in Illinois, you would need to tell them, for example, "Well, if we have to file a lawsuit in Illinois, I can't help you because that's a limitation on my conduct. I'm only admitted in Wisconsin." So you have to communicate those to them. And kind of the general byword of what you need to communicate to them, to measure how much information. And again, you can't go wrong by giving them too much. But you want to give them sufficient information so that they can participate intelligently in the decisions. So remember, again, Rule 1.2 kind of comes back into play, that the decisions are theirs. They are in the driver's seat. And what you need to do is give them enough information so that they can intelligently occupy the driver's seat and make those decisions. But the comment does go on to say this, that you don't need to describe everything that you do in excruciating detail. But keep in mind that it does not hurt if you go into excruciating detail. So keep your client informed so that they can be in the driver's seat. Well, as we noted in the preamble, we have obligations to our clients, but the rules also recognize that lawyers need to earn a living. We have house payments and car payments and student loan payments, and it's nice to buy some groceries now and then. So it's reasonable to think that lawyers should be able to earn a living. Therefore, we have to charge fees to our clients. But our fees and expenses must not be unreasonable. And again, that's one that's hardly a black letter rule. You know, what is reasonable, what is unreasonable. But the rule does provide some factors that we can look at to make that decision. The amount of time and labor required. So traditionally, we bill by the hour. Time and labor required. Novelty and difficulty. Something that, you know, every lawyer has done 100 times, you probably can't charge as much for as for something very novel. Whether the representation will prevent you from taking other employment. So if it's a case where you're going to be continuously involved in their trial for the next 6 months and you can't take other cases that come in, that's a factor to keep in mind, that you that the reasonable fee would be a little bit higher. The customary charge in the locality, so if you're charging twice as much as the lawyer down the street or the lawyers down the street, then that might be one factor to keep in mind. The amount involved and the results obtained. So the million-dollar case might be entitled to a higher reasonable fee than a very small case. Time limitations. So if the client comes in the night before the statute of limitations is about to run, that would be a reasonable factor that perhaps you could charge that person more than if somebody gave you more notice and allowed you to work on it a little bit more leisurely. The nature and length of your relationship with the client. So somebody who's been a longtime client, they probably will not be able to argue that the fee is unreasonable, whereas a new guy just walking in might be able to say that same fee would be unreasonable. Your experience and reputation is one factor. So if you have a name for yourself, the rule recognizes that you can charge more because of that name. And finally, whether the fee is fixed or contingent. And we'll talk about contingency fees in a minute. But you can charge more in a contingency fee case than you would if you're just charging a flat hourly fee. So if a case where you get $3 million, $1 million fee in that case is probably reasonable if it's a contingency fee. But if you do 1 hour of work and get the $3 million, then maybe the $1 million is not reasonable for that 1 hour of preparation if it's not a contingency fee. But the rule also says that that these are not exclusive. Other factors could enter into whether or not a fee is reasonable. Now, one that is pretty easy to violate, and Wisconsin actually gives a little bit of a safe harbor, is that you are required to communicate with your client in writing the fee and scope of representation. So, for example, in Minnesota and Iowa, if a client called me up and said, "How much would it cost to do a simple will?" and I just say $500, and I'm a nice guy, so I just say, "Well, just pay me when the case is over, and I'll get to work and I'll write your will, and you can pay me $500 when I'm all finished," and nothing is in writing. Well, that's a violation of the rules in Minnesota and Iowa. And if I said $2,000, it would also be a violation in Wisconsin, because that fee and scope of representation needs to be communicated in writing. Now, it doesn't specify what kind of writing, and it doesn't say the client has to agree to it in writing, but you just have to communicate that fee information in writing. So now if they pay up front and you give them some kind of a receipt, well, that probably complies with the rule. But if you just tell them what your fee is going to be and what the scope is going to be, you know, $500 for one will, that needs to be communicated in writing. So just telling them that price over the phone would actually be a violation of this. And that's an easy violation to do in a case like that for something simple, because you know, if you get that call and you don't if you don't plan on just billing them after the fact, it's easy not to get that writing out there. So you want to get something in writing, get a letter to them saying, thank you for your phone call today. I'll get right to work on your will. The cost will be $500, or the cost will be $100 an hour, or however you're going to do it. Wisconsin builds in a little bit, and I think this is kind of reasonable, and other states should probably have this, build in kind of a safe harbor to deal with exactly that situation. Because in Wisconsin, if the reasonable fee in the case is going to be less than $1,000, this may be communicated orally. So, for example, if, that same situation, the person calls and says, how much is a will? And you say $500, I'll get right to work on it, and I'll bill you when it's over. That would be acceptable in Wisconsin because it's under $1,000. And it doesn't have to be just a fixed price below $1,000, but it's just reasonably foreseeable being less than that. So you can say, $100 an hour, it'll take me a couple of hours. That would be okay in Wisconsin, but not in the other states. So keep that in mind. And if the reasonably foreseeable cost is more than $1,000, so they call up and say, how much for my DWI? And you say, it'll be $3,000. Now, most DWIs, you probably want to get the fee up front, but if you just quoted that price over the phone, that would violate the rule because it's over $1,000. Moving to contingency fee, we said that's one relevant factor in whether the fee is reasonable. There are some specific requirements, and first of all, the fee agreement must be in writing, and it must be signed by the client. And I'm not going to go into specifically what that written contract has to say, but there are some very specifics in there. Most of them are kind of common sense. So chances are, if you do take cases on a contingency fee basis, you probably have a contract pre-printed or on your word processor. But if you're starting out and you want to write that contract to put on your word processor, then you do need to take a look at Rule 1.5 and make sure that you have all of those requirements covered. But it must be in writing and it must be signed by the client. So remember, the letter that you sent to your client saying that your case will cost $1,001, that does not need to be signed by the client. It just has to be in writing. But the contingency fee, the fee in this case will be one-third. That needs to be signed by the client. And incidentally, this does not apply just to what we normally think of as contingency fee agreements, one-third in the civil case. It covers anything where your fee varies depending upon the outcome of the case. Your fee is contingent on what happens in the case. And a contingency fee is not allowed in two situations. It's not allowed in family law cases, so you cannot say, I will take one-third of the spousal maintenance or the child support, or you can't even say, you will pay me $1,000 if we get custody, because, again, contingency fee does not just mean a percentage of the case, is how we normally think. It can mean different outcomes. So if we get custody, then I get paid. If we don't get custody, I don't get paid. Well, that's a contingency fee because that is based upon the outcome of the case, and it's not allowed in family law cases. The other kind of case where it's not allowed is criminal cases. And again, in a criminal case, you're not getting one-third of anything. You're not going to get one-third of the jail time, hopefully. But again, any time the fee depends upon the outcome of the case. One interesting case, and I don't remember the site for it, but I believe it's from Wisconsin, kind of a famous one. In fact, I think they even put this on the bar exam, the multi-state bar exam, was that a DWI attorney, I believe in Wisconsin, was advertising if we lose your DWI case, I will give you a bicycle. Well, that was held to be a contingent fee because if the lawyer won the case, he got a certain amount of money. If he lost the case, then he got that same amount of money minus the cost of a bicycle. So in that case, that was held to be a contingency fee, and that was held to be improper. fee splitting between attorneys. Here's one where I want to add in one little clarification for Iowa and Minnesota. Wisconsin is pretty much accurate what is said here. If you split the fee with another attorney, it must be in Minnesota and Wisconsin, or Minnesota and Iowa, it must be in proportion to the services provided by each lawyer. And I should also add that both Minnesota and Iowa also include language that it doesn't have to be just in proportion to the services, but it can also be if you maintain responsibility for the case, that it is permissible to split fee. But it can't just be a flat-out referral fee. So it can't be, you know, the other lawyer will pay you 10% on all of the personal injury cases you send. That would be improper because that 10%, unless that 10% was in proportion to the services you provided. So did you provide 10% of the value to your client? And that's the best way of looking at this. I think the fee is reasonable if you are providing that much value to your client, as opposed to are you providing that much value to the other lawyer. And in Minnesota and Iowa, under the rules, that can be either in proportion to the services, not necessarily mathematically down to the last hour, or it can be the responsibility that you continue to assume. So you continue to sign the pleadings, but the other attorney is involved in the case as well. Well, then you could split the fee with the other attorney in that case because you're maintaining the responsibility because you're signing things, so you are still responsible for it. Or even if you're not, you know, perhaps it's a case where you're not an expert in personal injury cases, but you have a trusted relationship with the client. Well, maybe that client is going to feel better if you go to the deposition with him rather than this unfamiliar attorney. So you're still providing services. Wisconsin changed the wording a little bit from the model rule because the model rule says in proportion to the services provided by each lawyer. And Wisconsin uses the words based on. And when you look at their comments, they went to the word based on just to make sure, just to clarify that it's not mathematical certainty. You know, if you in order to get 10% of the fee, you had to work exactly 10% of the hours in the case. That's not what the rule requires, and it's probably not what it requires in the other states as well. But Wisconsin changed that wording just to say that it doesn't have to be, a mathematical calculation to determine it. So you are allowed fees. You are allowed contingency fees. The fees cannot be unreasonable, and there are limited situations where contingency fees are allowed. They are allowed pretty much everything except family law or criminal cases. Well, okay, so that's our clients. Again, all these rules that start with one are talking about our relationship with our client and talking about our responsibilities to our client. Rule 1.5 talks about the client's responsibility to pay. Well, moving back to what our responsibilities are to our client with Rule 1.6 is that in general, everything is confidential, period. And there are some exceptions to that. But pretty much everything that happens during the course of representation of a client is, unless proven otherwise, confidential. Because the rule states is that you shall not reveal information relating to a representation of a client unless the client gives informed consent. And then there are some exceptions. So again, this is much broader than any kind of evidentiary privilege. It does not say a lawyer may not reveal confidential information that he got from his client. No, it's you may not, unless there's an exception, you may not reveal anything that happened during the course of the case. If you got this information that is otherwise public knowledge, if you got that information and it relates to the representation of a client, that is presumptively confidential. Now, there are exceptions. First of all, disclosures that are impliedly authorized in order to carry out the representation. So obviously, if the client comes in and says, I want to sue the insurance company, you have to tell the insurance company, you know, my client's name is so-and-so, and he is suing you. So obviously there, that's that release of information is impliedly authorized because that's what your client wants you to do, you know, reveal that information. But other than that, there has to be a specific exception in the rule. And there are limited exceptions. Now, here is one case, though, where you have two conflicting interests, and there is not a safe side that you can do, because one of the exceptions to it in all three states is that you as a lawyer shall reveal information if you believe that it's necessary to prevent the client from committing a criminal or fraudulent act that will result in death or serious bodily injury or substantial financial or property damage. So here, that exception is not that you may reveal the information, it's that you shall reveal the information. But if it doesn't come under that exception, then you shall not reveal it. So here is a case where you can't say, well, I'm going to take the safe side and reveal the information because maybe it's a criminal or fraudulent act. Well, no, because then if you guessed wrong, you're violating the main rule that you shall not reveal confidential information. But on the other hand, if you think the other side is the safe side, well, I'm not going to reveal this information because I think it's confidential. Well, then you're in trouble if it turns out it was criminal or fraudulent act. So this is one where there is no safe way around the rule. It has to fit under one of those categories, and you better get the right one in Minnesota and Iowa. And in those states, and Wisconsin as well, but as we'll see in a moment, Wisconsin has something that's a bit more helpful for the practitioner. But you shall reveal the information, and this is true in all three states, if you believe that it's necessary to prevent your client from committing a crime or fraud, and it can't just be any crime or fraud, crime or fraud must either result in death or serious bodily injury, or substantial financial or property damage. So if your client says, I'm going to murder somebody today, well, then you probably are required to reveal that information to stop your client. But if your client says, I'm going to go shoplifting now, well, that one you probably are not allowed to reveal because that's not going to cause death or serious bodily injury or substantial property damage. So it's this one you have to look at the exact wording of the rule. Now, Wisconsin builds in a little bit of a safe harbor because again the rule in the other states is that in these cases you may not reveal the information, in these cases you must reveal the information. Wisconsin builds in a middle ground of where you may reveal the information, and there, you may reveal the information to prevent death or substantial bodily harm or to prevent, mitigate, or rectify substantial financial or property injury. So it still has to be a substantial harm, but to the case where you may reveal it, it might not be a crime or a fraud. So, for example, if your client is going to do something that will cause injury to somebody, even if it's not a crime, but if it's substantial injury or substantial bodily harm, then you may reveal that information. But that is kind of a safe harbor, because in that situation, it merely says that you may reveal it. It does not say that you must reveal it. And finally, as we pointed out before, you may reveal certain client confidences to secure legal advice about your conduct under these rules. So if you're asking for legal advice, calling up the Bar Association or the board regulating lawyers or an attorney saying, what do you think I should do in this situation? Should I reveal this information or should I should I give this money to my client or should I keep the money? When you're seeking legal advice about what you can do under the rules,